Hello, and welcome to Conversations with the Legal Academy, a podcast from the University of Arkansas School of Law. My name is Dorinda Sharp.
And I'm Colin Hesse. On this episode, Tanya Jacoby, a professor at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law, discusses her research on the hidden psychology of constitutional criminal procedure. Professor Jacoby was on campus in January of 2017 as part of the Law School Speaker Exchange.
We hope you enjoy the conversation. And you've just spoken to some of your colleagues in our law school. How'd that go?
Oh, it was great. It was incredibly productive. I presented a paper that's already finished and then also a follow-on paper that was very much at the early stages. And so I got a lot of interesting comments and suggestions and questions relating to the second one, which I can still do work on. So it's very helpful.
Well, why don't you talk a little bit about what it's about?
Okay. So the original paper was essentially arguing that there are a lot of ways in which women and other categories as well talk about, but women versus men express themselves differently, perceive things differently, and feel differently and react differently to those perceptions. And none of that is recognized in the jurisprudence surrounding criminal procedure. So
okay.
All of the powers that the police have to stop a person on the street, ask them questions, potentially seize them, arrest them, whether they have to Mirandize them, all of those sorts of rules in relating to citizen rights as against the state to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. None of that jurisprudence reflects these well-established differences between men and women in that expression, perception, and behavior.
So in your research, are you just looking at the differences or the outcomes that may or may not happen because of those differences, like how people are treated possibly differently because of how they react?
Well, I mean, there's definitely going to be a difference in outcome in terms of whether women can effectively assert their rights. For example, can they assert their right to counsel that Miranda tells us we have? But if the way that women express themselves typically means that the courts won't recognize that as an invocation of those rights, then they don't really have those rights in the same way that men do. And the result of that will mean that women end up being interrogated when they have already said, I'd like to see a lawyer, but they didn't say, use the right magical words, I want to see a lawyer. They'll say, perhaps I should see a lawyer, which is a very typical way that women express themselves, especially when they're in the situation where they feel that they're being evaluated by an outside observer, such as a police officer, particularly when they're in a position where they might feel somewhat afraid and perceive that they don't have freedom to leave, for example, which in an arrest situation is certainly true.
I would guess there's an authority figure component of that, too, that,
Yes. Speaking
in generalities, women are less likely to push back against an authority figure than...
They're more likely just to acquiesce
yeah.
than they are to stand up and assert their rights, both because they perceive fear more, they perceive themselves to be subject to something that creates a sense of fear. Not having full freedom. And then also the way that they're likely to express their attempts to assert themselves will seem less assertive. One of the unfortunate effects is that when women don't express themselves that way, there is this reaction against that. So they're more likely to face hostility and be seen as being very aggressive, even if they're actually less aggressive than the average man, but more aggressive than the expectation of how women are meant to be, they'll be perceived as very aggressive and you're more likely to have a hostile reaction.
So you were saying there hasn't been research done in this. What led you to decide to dig into this?
So there has been research. There's a lot of social science, particularly psychology evidence, but also some linguistic studies showing the differences between men and women. That's not my original research.
Mm-hmm.
What astonishes me, and the reason I wrote this article and I'm writing the follow-on article, is that there hasn't been very much putting the two together and saying, look, this is how a jurisprudence is, and it's this artifice pretending that men and women are the same. And in fact, most of the tests are not even sort of the average between men and women. They're based on men.
Yeah.
And then to the extent that women don't respond in that way, then they just don't get protected.
Let's kind of back up in your life a little bit. Was your undergrad in political science?
Yes. Yeah.
And you have a master's in that as well?
I have a PhD in political science. I came to the U.S. to do a PhD, and I did that at Stanford. I did my undergraduate and my law degree in Australia.
So what led you to teaching law?
Well, when I came over and did a political science PhD, when I began it, I thought I would be teaching political science, uh-huh. but teaching the judicial politics side of political science. And then the more I got into it, the more I realized that it would be great to teach at a law school, but bring that political perspective and bring that social science methodology to the law school. And I think both are good routes, but I really like being in an environment where everybody's talking about the law and everyone's, you know, knows the judges, knows the Supreme Court justices and can talk about that. Whereas within political science, there's a kind of sense that the law is on the outside. It's not really the essence of political science. Mm-hmm. So you're always on the very edges. I had a professor in my first year, before I switched to Stanford, I started at Berkeley, and I had a professor tell me that as far as he was concerned, there only were two branches of government. And that was in 1999, and in 2000, I really wanted to write to him and say, what do you say now?
Yeah, no kidding. So I assume he meant executive and legislative.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. That's really interesting.
Yeah. And I don't think that that's representative. But I do right. think that the courts are sort of, they're more treated as an add-on. Whereas when you're at a law school, they're front and center.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That's why you're there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as a law school, the University of Arkansas is a little bit different than a lot of schools because we are right in the middle of a university campus. Yeah. So we've got lots.
Very nice. It's beautiful. I've had a little wander around.
Good. So we've got lots of undergraduates around, and we've got a pre-law program, and, you know, we've got a coffee shop and our law library, and so people are in and out a lot, and I think it makes a lot of our undergrads maybe consider law school when they might not have otherwise, and they often look for advice. What would you say to an undergraduate that's considering maybe going to law school?
I mean, I think it depends on what they want to do, what they want to get out of it. I think that law is a great generalist degree. Even if you don't want to be an advocate or even if you don't want to be a lawyer, it can open up a lot of possibilities. I mean, say you want to be a lobbyist or say you want to run a business. Like a law degree, it's an expensive side hobby, but it does actually come in very handy, you know, for all sorts of different activities as well as just sort of, you know, your TV show lawyer. And so I think there are a lot of good reasons to go to law school, but there's time and money costs. So it's not necessarily something you want to jump into without a particularly clear idea of what you want to do. But I think I love studying law. I think it's a really valuable thing to do. And there's so many different aspects that if there's not something there that's of interest to you, then you know, it's surprising.
But, yeah. Well, by the same token, since you had a varied background, what do you think in your background really prepared you to succeed in the legal profession and academics?
I love arguing. And I don't just mean that, you know, in terms of, you know, you want to be an advocate, but just playing with ideas and analyzing them and taking a position that I don't necessarily agree with, but I can argue that position. I did a lot of debating when I was in school and in college as well, and it was the best preparation I could possibly. That's, I guess, a piece of advice as well. If you seriously do want to be a lawyer, then debating is a great way to prepare for that because you learn to structure an argument on the run. Mm-hmm. You learn how to respond. You get to learn how to argue a position that's not necessarily your favorite ideological position, but that's a skill unto itself. And often in the classroom, a student will put up their hand and they'll put forward a perspective, and I'll say, "That's great. Now, how would you counter that?" And often their initial reaction is to say, "Well, no, I agree with what I said." And I'm like, "Okay, but that's not who's hiring you on this particular day. Now argue against it." And I think the student that can do that and who enjoys doing that is going to be the best lawyer. Yeah. So
that's great advice. So what are you looking at next? I mean, I know you're doing more of, you're expanding this research,
yes.
But what else are you
I'm expanding
planning?
This research, and I'm actually doing another, as it happens, I'm doing another project on gender, which is only my second project on gender. I am building a database where I look at Supreme Court oral arguments, but in particular, the justices' being interrupted and interrupting each other. And I've already found this huge gender effect. Oh. So even when you don't account for the fact that there are so fewer women on the Supreme Court than there ever have been of men, even when you don't account for that, women are interrupted more often than men.
Wow.
And it's the men who do the interrupting on the whole, not entirely. But I also looked at advocates and coded them as male versus female advocates. And the advocates, the male advocates are interrupting the women a lot. And the female advocates are down the very bottom, as they're supposed to be. The advocates are not meant to interrupt the justices.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really interesting to think about in relation to my project that I was just telling you about, in that one of the effects that's meant to counteract the effect of gender in the way, you know, women hedge when they speak, they don't say things as assertively.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the effects that's supposed to counter that is class. The higher your class, the less likely you are to do that as a woman. So if you're, for example, an expert giving testimony, you're less likely to hedge because you know you've got this experience behind you and people will take you seriously and not challenge you. But here we have the women who've achieved the highest pinnacle within a very high status career to begin with,
yeah.
and they are still just being talked over because they're women. And I look at, I control for seniority, I control for ideology, and the effect is pretty clear. So I think that says a lot about no matter how well a woman does, there's still a tendency of men to interrupt. And the other thing I look at is the extent to which having interrupted, you then recognize the fact that you've interrupted and perhaps apologize.
Oh, yeah.
And when men interrupt each other, which they still do, but not nearly as often, they're much more likely to recognize that that's what they did or apologize or cede the floor. And they don't do it to women. So they don't even know that they don't even see that they're interrupting.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And when you start doing work on this, you start noticing, like, interruption patterns, from, you know, just in your everyday life.
Yeah.
And